Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robin Hood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Well, thank you, Marshall, and welcome back to Off Script. You know, we resumed the Off Script original broadcast just last week after some hiatus with the pandemic. And the point was that I would resume having conversations, as I have every summer, with the artistic directors and principals from the major theater companies in the listening area, the Berkshires and the Hudson Valley. And since the pandemic of just now 3 months ago, it is now June 3rd, and it has been 10 days since May 25th, the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, and we have seen a civic crisis in this country. So there are two pandemics of sort, both a health one and also, also a health one too, except in a political and civic form. So we can't acknowledge we can't really discuss theater without acknowledging that. And my guest today is artistic director of the Chester Theater Company in Chester, Massachusetts, which just yesterday addressed the civic crisis that we're going through in a really important press release. And so joining me today is Daniel Kramer, the artistic director of Chester Theater Company. And welcome, Daniel. And let's just talk about that. Yesterday, the Chester Theater Company made a statement of support for Black Lives Matter and the rest of it. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. It's interesting to think about. Obviously, a lot of things go on in this country, and we don't have an announcement to make about all of them. And so obviously we're far from alone. We weren't the first theater. We won't be the last theater to have something to say about this. But it felt clear that we were in a moment that demands as many voices as possible. And so we added ours, not because we think ours is particularly special, but because we thought that failing to add it was to fail to be citizens of this society and this country in the ways that we need to be and the ways that we hope we are as a theater. Not because we think that we are going to, change minds and hearts because we've issued a press release or sent out an announcement to our audiences, but because it felt important to speak on this issue. It felt important to express what's happening. And I think this is really critical for me, at least. We are a largely, if I'm being honest, we are a largely white institution. We have three year-round staff members. All three of us are white. If you come to see a production of ours, you will see, depending what day or night you are there, a largely or possibly even entirely white audience at times. Really, the largest diversity tends to be among the artists who are part of the company in the summer. So we don't think that we are the people who should be saying a great deal about this, but we are people and we are an institution positioned to help amplify the voices who should be speaking and are speaking and who should be heard. And the hope was that to make an announcement was to amplify those voices whom we ought to be listening to in this country right now.
Yeah, and in Chester, Massachusetts, for those who are not familiar with your theater, and it is about the pretty white small town New England, America. As the crow flies, it's 15 minutes due east of Jacob's Pillow. For those of us who are familiar with the lay of the land in the cultural Berkshires, the statement does follow a wave of statements that have come from the leading and the cultural institutions, not just national institutions, but regional and smaller theater companies like your own. For those who are not familiar with Chester Theater Company, give us a little bit of background about the origins of the theater and what's distinctive about it and what the mission is.
Sure. The theater company is about 30 years old now. It was actually originally founded by the Irish director, Vincent Dowling, who had been a longtime director and briefly artistic director First of all, at the Abbey Theater in Dublin, and then ran Great Lakes Festival in Cleveland for a number of years. And I sometimes say that he was a man who was expert at everything except retiring. So when he moved to Chester, he ended up starting this little theater company. He ran it for a few years. He was succeeded about a year after he stepped down by Byam Stevens, who ran the company for, believe it or not, 18 years. And I've run it for, I've produced four seasons on the stage at Chester. We are in the town hall of Chester, Massachusetts. It's a very small town. It's not a very big town hall. We seat about 130 people. We do contemporary plays. And you are astonishingly close to wonderful actors when you come see a play there. And I think that we've long felt that one of the things that sets us apart is the kind of community that we create of artists and audience together right there in the town hall of Chester. As you know, we are not directly next to anything else. I used to joke that we should change our motto to Chester Theater Company, 40 beautiful minutes from anywhere. And we, I think, pride ourselves in doing plays where when you get in the car to drive home, you don't get in the car and think to yourself, what's for dinner tonight? But rather you get in the car and you want with your companions to talk about the experience you just shared.
Yeah.
So that's a very, very both brief and possibly more long-winded than I meant description of who we are.
Well, that's okay, but because I know you like all theaters, have wrestled with how to deal with the pandemic, how to continue theater, and I know that recently you had to make the disappointing choice not to have any live theater season in 2020. Other Berkshire theaters have taken different routes. Some are actually modifying their theaters and selling seats to productions that they hope can be safely presented and with a safely distanced audience at the end of August, beginning of September. Another theater company is going with exclusively audio full summer season. But tell us what went into the thinking of Chester so that it just couldn't do it for real this time.
Absolutely. You know, I think that first off, we had less painful decisions to make in some ways than year-round theaters, which were in the midst of productions as the pandemic developed and became so troubling, that were in rehearsals for shows that never opened. I certainly have many artist friends who were in one or both of those circumstances. For us, the first decision we actually had to make was about a trip rather than about a production. We travel every March with a number of our audience members to London for a week of theater. And the first decision we had to make was that that trip that was scheduled for March 14th could not take place. That's a decision that we finalized on March 2nd. And even on March 2nd, that felt a little big as a choice to a few of our folks who were hoping to travel, though obviously as events developed, it became clear we couldn't have been there. There was, in fact, no theater by the time we were supposed to start seeing plays in London. So the real decision we had to make first was that, and because that was a decision that was exclusively about the safety of our audience, it became, I think, paramount for us to start from that question. What was safe? And by the time we had to decide that we were not going to have our summer season, we began by eliminating three of the four shows in the hopes that perhaps we might preserve the final show. We finally had to come to the decision that that wasn't possible either. It was a painful thing to have to do, but it was not a difficult decision, if that makes sense.
In case you're just joining us, the program is Off Script. I'm Dan Dwyer, the host, and my guest is Daniel Kramer, who's the producing artistic director of Chester Theater Company. Daniel, one of the impetuses for this, for having you come on Off Script, was my having listened to your webinar a couple of weeks ago with Matt Wolfe, who is the critic and academic host of your trips to London that you're just describing. It was a great webinar, and Matt had a lot of things to say about theater in the age of pandemic. Can somebody still find that interview that you did with Matt online? Because it's a great one to listen to.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for checking in on that. And it was a treat to have you at it, by the way. Yes, you can. If you go to our website, chestertheater.org, we have a video recording of that webinar with Matt, who, as you say, is a wonderful, really thoughtful and knowledgeable person about so many aspects of London theater in particular and of theater more broadly.
And we should note he's the critic for the international edition of the New York Times.
Yes, and
besides contributing to other publications.
Yeah, and I'm sure a number of your listeners will have read many of his reviews or articles, some of which find their way into the New York Times here in our U.S. edition as well. But he's a remarkable person in terms of his knowledge of theater and London theater, and it was fascinating to hear his thoughts both on the season that had been going on and on current and possible future circumstances there.
Yeah. A lot of the discussion was about, the discussion got into what kind of theater can be staged in the pandemic. And we should broaden this, and I hope we will before we end this conversation about what kind of theater we will get after the George Floyd experience and Black Lives Matter and all that. But besides being a director, artistic director at theater, you're a practitioner, you're a director. So you go through what it takes to get stuff up on a stage and how you block it and all that. And if you had to direct something today, and I don't know if that's tenable, how would you begin?
That's a great question. There are circumstances in regular directing as I have known it where you're concerned with safety. Right. If you have stage combat, you might be concerned with safety. Of late in theater, we've also been looking more and more at intimacy as in some ways akin to stage combat, a circumstance where you want to make sure that people are and feel safe on stage. But this level of saying mere proximity brings peril, brings danger, is astonishing to think about how you would work with, right? There are so many plays, and I think in many ways theater exists to say, what happens when people are together? How do we interact with each other? How do we combine? How do we engage? What do we do with each other, to each other, for each other? And to try to think about, that's great, but also please stay at least 6 feet apart. Don't do the kind of vocal production. You know, one of the things that I've been reading is that singing is actually one of the activities that can carry the virus furthest. And an actor who's well-trained in using their voice, even in speaking, I'm sure sends it further than other people might in everyday conversation. And to imagine, how do we tell these stories while at the same time maintaining the kinds of distance that will keep people safe? Or does it change what stories we have to tell while we're in these circumstances? You know, you were talking about that Matt Wolff conversation, and you raised a question during it about one of the plays we had intended to see in London was Endgame by Samuel Beckett. And you pointed out that Beckett in many ways may be the perfect playwright of social distancing, in that he explores for us so much the ways that people do not connect. He explores for us so much the ways in which our individual trajectories fail to combine. And I wonder whether, at least if I had to direct a play right now, would I be drawn to a play like that where you could do it in perhaps its fullness? Or is it about saying that as we have to in real life, we need on stage to explore how we can stay connected, even while maintaining that physical distance and safety.
Yeah. Looking back at Endgame, for example, I can't recall if any of the characters ever touch. The two parents are in trash cans, safely distanced from each other. And Ham, what's his name?
Ham and Clove are the other
they
two.
Never, I don't think they ever touch. But any of, and I'm also, and think of Happy Days, where, you know, we're Stuck in the Sand. What's her one of that Whitney. Wonderful? Whitney, Stuck in the Sand. Yeah. And then from the other sand dune, this other guy comes crawling over. Anyway, yeah, the content's going to change somehow. I for one, don't think that it's all going to be back to light and happy and just give me something that's frothy entertaining. I'm not sure how we as a nation can go through what we've done, both what we have, both in terms of the pandemic and in terms of the George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, and not see how fragile it all is.
I hope that's true. I feel like if we come back and we do exactly what we were doing beforehand, then we've failed to learn, we failed to grow in ways that are vital. You know, a few weeks ago when the pandemic was sort of the only topic and we were not in the midst of what I think we have to describe as uprisings against a system of violence in this country, we were having lots of conversations about, you know, how will we stage when we come back? What sort of plays will we want? Will we want cheerful things? Will we want, you know, and my sense was that we were in fact going to want community. We were in fact going to want to find how to celebrate our ability to come back together. But of course, as we face the protests that have grown out of the death of George Floyd and of course his murder only in a long line of deaths and murders, I think it's clear that we need also to be talking about the voices that American theater as an institution and Chester Theater Company as a small part of that have not given enough space to, enough stage time, enough amplification to. So I think that that's also going to be a vital part of what I certainly know we will be looking at, what I hope the theater more broadly will be looking at. What not only is our role in what comes next, but what has been our role, winning and unwitting, in the failures that preceded the moment we're in.
Yeah, yeah. When you talked before about how things would be staged safely and still thoroughly engage an audience, you've had so many fine productions at Chester Theatre Company, but the one that I really think was extraordinary by any measure, not just the standards of Chester Theatre Company, but by any fine theatrical experience anywhere, was your production of Every Brilliant Thing. Talk about that and how, looking back at it, how privileged you were able to stage it when something like that could be staged, because you couldn't do it today.
You absolutely couldn't. I mean, it is a play that brings actor and audience together even more fully than perhaps the somewhat abstract way I normally mean when I talk about that. So Every Brilliant Thing by Duncan Macmillan, a British playwright and written in part with the British performer Johnny Donahoe, is a play in which a young man, actually a boy at the beginning, starts trying to keep a list of every wonderful thing in the world in order to help his mother, who's suffering from depression, and in order to convince her why she should look forward to life as opposed to dreading it. And as he grows to be a man, he finds that this list is critical for his own well-being and his own sense of hopefulness in the world. And the wonderful actor Joel Ripka came up and performed that role. And we converted our theater, which is normally proscenium theater, to In the Round, because he interacts with the audience in a million different ways over the course of that show. He asks them to call out the things that are wonderful in the world. They play relatives of his. They play his teacher. They come on stage and hold a keyboard so that he can sing songs. They high-five him. They do all kinds of things. And it is an astonishingly affirming piece. But as you point out, a piece that in a moment where we fear that we could be infected by our proximity to or physical interaction with others, it would be impossible to produce. It was a joyful thing for us to do. Joel is such an astonishing actor, both technically fine and then just a beautiful person, which I think shines out of him in his work. I'm sure you had that experience seeing him. And it is frightening to me to think that at least in the short term, that's a kind of play we couldn't possibly do.
Yeah. Looking back at the last 3 months, besides the turmoil and the tragedies of the pandemic, and besides the upheaval of George Floyd and the ensuing civic crisis in the country, let's take a minute to acknowledge another loss. Larry Kramer died about 4 or 5 days ago. A leading voice for so many things and such a huge contributor to how theater can change things. Talk to us a little bit about this.
Yeah, it's so important to think about him right now. I mean, he just passed a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, folks may know Larry Kramer a couple of different ways, and they're all important and all intertwined, right? He was a playwright. He actually was also a screenwriter who wrote some very successful films, films that won Oscars. He's best known as a playwright for his play, The Normal Heart, which was a critical play in terms of bringing in front of audiences some of whom had not had as much direct experience of the way that the AIDS crisis was taking so many lives and destroying so many futures, and putting those stories in front of audiences, some of whom needed to see their life reflected, the life they knew they were in, some of whom needed to see a life they didn't know enough about, put on stage in front of them. But of course, he was also an astonishingly powerful activist. He was both a co-founder of Gay Men's Health Crisis, and then when he felt that they were not being radical enough in their actions, he went on to form ACT UP. And that model of saying my art and my activism are all intertwined and I will do whichever thing it is that will make change is a powerful one. And I think we have to wonder what will grow out of the current circumstances. What stories will these circumstances lead to? I feel as an artistic director that part of my job is simply to make sure that I am hearing them and giving them space on our stage.
Mm-hmm. One of the criticisms of The Normal Heart, which along with Angels in America, it'd be interesting to see which of those for entirely different reasons becomes emblematic of the AIDS canon that in theater. Well, anyway, one of the criticisms of Normal Heart is that it's a polemic, and which invites the question, is there anything wrong with polemical theater anyway? And if we could justify theater being polemical again, isn't this the time to have polemical theater?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there are interesting questions here, right? What is theater for? What do we go there for? What are we looking for from it? What does it offer us? And I think that there are times we are sustained by joy. I think there are times we are sustained by our complex encounters with character. I think there are times we are sustained by calls to action. And that can be as vital an artistic experience as anything else. So I think the question is not, is it art or is it polemic? But when and where is a polemic the art we need? When and where is that what will sustain us? Mm-hmm. The sense that we can take action that makes a difference is a vital sense. And I think one of the ones that we need to feel moving forward. And as you say, The Normal Heart certainly took criticism for being largely a call to action. Here's what is right. Here's what is wrong. Here's what you should be doing. Here's what you shouldn't be doing. And yet sometimes isn't that what we want? Isn't that what we need?
Yeah. Of all this stuff, you're a professor at Smith, right? You're a director of an artistic theater program, and you direct as well. Of all the stuff that you've seen on the internet that's made during the time of pandemic or that is to be streamed, that's virtual theater, what do you think's been the most successful you've seen in the last couple of months?
It's such a tough circumstance for people, right? We want to put stuff out there. Theaters want to put things out there. And yet there's so much work being put out there that really was never developed to be seen the way that it's now being offered. You know, and I think that speaks for me to one of the things that I found most effective, which is Richard Nelson's play, We Need to Talk. It might be the title. I might have it slightly wrong.
Things we need to talk about, something like that. We know what we're talking about.
Yes. So anyway, the playwright Richard Nelson has been writing a group of plays about a fictional family called the Apple Family that have been produced at the Public Theater in New York. And he wrote the next part of their story, but he said now the Apple Family is, as all of us are, isolated during the pandemic, are in the midst of a stay-at-home order in their various places, and are engaging via Zoom. And it was so powerful, both because those characters were sharing circumstances we were living through and because it was written for the way that it was created. And I don't know about you, but I found that to be one of the absolutely most successful things that I've seen during this period of time.
Yeah, it was really emotionally satisfying. And not only from the narrative and from point of view, but also from the way it was produced. The Brady Bunch Matrix became a paradigm for virtual theater. Let's talk about getting back to the crisis that's erupted from the murder of George Floyd. Looking back at our history in civil rights, the one person that we should talk about, and I want to go back to one of your previous productions. It was not a typical take on Martin Luther King's production of The Mountaintop by Katori Hall, one of the theater's best feminine women voices and African-American voice as well. It gave us a point of view about Martin Luther King that was quite different. How does that fit into how we can think about what's going on these days?
I'm so glad you mentioned that production. There are a couple of things I want to say here, I think. First, I'd like to call out the names of some of the wonderful artists who came to create that work for us. You've already mentioned Katori Hall, the marvelous playwright. We had an astonishing cast for that play, Jordan Mahome as Dr. King, Shelley Fort as Kameh, and Shelley was actually a student of mine some years back, and the wonderful director Colette Robert, who has continued to come make work with us over these years, who all contributed their voices and their talents to that production. It's so interesting to think about Dr. King and his work for me. He is called out by so many different parts of our society as a model, and yet he is so often brought out, I fear, to mollify. He is brought out in a sanitized way. His name and his memory are raised for us with all of the vital rough edges sanded down or ignored. And of course, that's not who he was. The play takes place in Memphis at the Lorraine Motel on the night before King's murder. And he is writing as the play begins. He's in fact saying the title of the sermon he plans to give the next day. And we know historically that this was the title of the sermon he was going to give the next day, but we don't know what its actual content was. He never finished writing it. But the sermon he's planning to give the next day is entitled, Why America is Going to Hell. It is not about how we're all going to live in peace together. It is not about how we need to be thoughtful and loving to each other. It is about why America is going to hell. It is about the great sin that this country not only is founded in, but continues to enact of the system of white power. And I think that that play is so powerful for the very reason that it reveals to us the full humanity of Dr. King and reveals to us the righteous anger that I think is called for in this moment, as in so many others in this country.
Yeah. Daniel, thank you for joining Off Script today. How can people keep in touch with Chester Theatre Company these days?
The thing I would ask you to do is come to our website and sign up to be part of our emails. We're doing a lot of different programs. You participated in that conversation that we had with Matt Wolf. We have some critics from other cities whom we'll be interviewing as well. We're also getting together, and when there are interesting productions that are available remotely, saying to people, here's when it's going to be, then come join us for a conversation, and we can still talk about theater and make community, which is what we do at Chester. So come to the website, sign up to be on our list, and you will learn about the chances we're creating for us to come together and for us to be in community.
Great. Daniel, thanks for joining us. And everybody out there, thanks for listening to the program Off Script. I'm the host, Dan Dwyer. Until the next time we tune in and hear from each other, stay well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from John and Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.